Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome to the food scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkell, here today with Kobe and Megan Geraltz from Bluestem, Kansas City, Missouri, not Kansas.
Right, Kansas City, Missouri.
I mean, Kansas ain't too far away, is it?
No, actually, we live on the Kansas side and we work on the Missouri side and spend our days going back and forth quite a bit.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, many people mix up the two, the city and the...
The state line actually runs... completely right through the middle of the city.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting.
It's a joke. It's some kind of inside joke that nobody knows about. So Bluestem, I'm going to let you explain what the restaurant, what the concept is in Kansas City, Missouri. Recently came out with a cookbook, which is fantastic. I'm flipping through the pages right now. But I met you guys years ago through a James Beard event. I'm not even exactly sure.
Yeah, it was probably 2006. It was right after, we were cooking at the Beard House and you had shot it.
Yeah, and so. I was kind of smitten not only with your food, but the rapport that was so easy and so almost Midwest. I think I gravitate towards that area of the country. But you were doing something in that kitchen, which was happening in New York, but was not happening where you were in Kansas City. Why there? Why Bluestem? Why not New York?
Well, Colby's hometown is Kansas City. He grew up there, and I'm actually a Chicago gal. So
yeah,
we were living on the West Coast. We lived in Las Vegas and Santa Monica, California. Wanted to come back to our home, to our roots, and really do a restaurant that represented our love for the middle of the country and to be near family, quite frankly. So we decided to find a little restaurant where we could do a small fine dining concept in. And when we originally opened, it's 13 tables, very tiny, and about 3 years later we were able to open and expand to an adjoining lounge where we could do more casual fare as well. But it's 13 tables, degustation menus. We also do some
I think we just spend a lot of time in, you know, really high end. We worked at True, we worked at Oriole. Mm-hmm. And we knew that there wasn't a lot of that going on in Kansas City, and I kind of felt like we had an opportunity to do something and stand out, and it worked.
Yeah. Well, you said you worked at True, Oriole, highly lauded, starred restaurants in the Midwest. And it wasn't in Kansas City. What was in Kansas City? Was it barbecue? Was it fried chicken?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I grew up on is really kind of, you know, homey food. You know, we didn't... if you went out to a nice restaurant on a Sunday night, yeah, you literally went to something that was the equivalent to a dive bar and you ate fried chicken and you know, you ate barbecue. The food scene there is very communal. You know, there's just when you get together and eat with people, it's usually family based and, you know, there's picnics and the summertime barbecues and things like that. And, you know, when we first opened Bluestem, I think that ourselves included in much of the food scene that was there was trying desperately to run away from that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Kansas City's always been known as a food town from barbecue and fried chicken and some of the communal style restaurants that exist. There are a lot of dive bars and roadside, you know, the roadside barbecue we went to a few weeks ago for Blues and barbecue. But there's not a whole lot of upscale fine dining restaurants. So we knew that we could kind of be a big fish in a small pond in that regard, but also come back to some regionality with Bluestem and doing a small restaurant there to embrace some of those food cultures that already exist in Kansas City.
Yeah, aside from barbecue and fried chicken, are there other regional snack sandwiches that are, you know, renowned there?
I don't know about that. I mean, there's lots of you know, cured meats and hams and things like that.
There's
but I don't know
local
about
dairies,
sandwiches. And
a lot of local cheeses that exist. Mm-hmm. You know, we also have a lot of Chris Elbow is a good friend of ours, and he's a local chocolatier who does artisan chocolates. He has a shop there and also out in San Francisco, too. So Kansas City is represented there. Everything is represented there. It's just smaller. You know,
yeah.
In New York, you'll find a lot of little chocolate places, but in Kansas City, there's one or two. But we have everything. And, you know, like I said, it's always been a food town, and it's ever growing and ever changing and evolving more and more.
And it's funny. Not only do you have everything, but we figured out a connection through Heritage Foods.
Yeah.
Which is Paradise Lockers.
Yep. Paradise Lockers in Trimble, Missouri, which is about 45 minutes to an hour north of the metro area.
Yeah. And what are they and what do they do?
They're a meat processing plant. And, yeah, they deal with, you know, all the heritage growers and, you know, lots of boutique farmers out there. That it's funny you say boutique farmers. They don't consider themselves boutique farmers. They just consider themselves farmers. Yeah,
this year's atelier.
Yeah, line. Exactly.
Yes.
But, you know, they're just smaller production people that, you know, believe in, you know, raising stuff correctly and not the big feedlots. And, you know, so anyway, you can take about anything there and they'll process it for you. And, you know, they're a great company, great people.
Yeah, it's funny that I mean that's such a major thing lacking here in New York right now, that you know we have to go to Kansas City.
Yeah,
we have to go to Missouri.
No, there's a lot of big chefs that buy directly from Paradise Locker. We kind of have a middleman in between that we buy through, but you know we go up there and they've got a retail store in there. You can walk in, you know, you can't really say off the street, off the gravel road, I suppose, and walk in and They have tons and tons of high quality stuff.
Yeah. What are some of the more interesting cuts you've gotten from Paradise?
Oh, I don't know. I don't think anything's really that strange anymore.
Yeah.
You know, lots of oxtails and tongues and liver and, you know, heart and you name it. We've gotten about everything. So.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's just nice to see that the offal is not only being processed but purchased and used there.
Oh yeah,
sure.
They're still a little hard on the, you know, in New York.
This
mecca of culinary, you know, delights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's some, you know, there's some stuff you can get away with more than others. But I mean, definitely oxtails and tongues and stuff like that. We use quite a bit.
Yeah. So I mean, in Kansas City, people aren't scared of that kind of ingredient.
Some are, some aren't.
Yeah, yeah.
It depends on where you are. It's funny. The more in the city you get, the more fearful they are, believe it or not. But,
yeah,
yeah.
You know,
more out in the country.
In the country, you'll
whatever you can find. Sometimes
go cut wood with an old timer, and he'll pull head cheese out of his pocket and just start eating it. And it's kind of interesting.
Pocket head cheese.
Colby, yeah. Colby's actually done that.
Yeah, no, my dad's got a funny story about that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and you're still living after that.
Yeah,
yeah,
yep, yep. Believe it or not. It is.
So, what are the things that you try to inflect and import into Kansas City that weren't there before?
You know, I just think more of a philosophy, a cooking philosophy, as far as, you know, refinement is concerned, you know, and as much as we go that direction, you know.
Well, I think featuring regional food, giving it the respect that it deserves, you know. When we first opened Blue Stem, our cheese selection, for instance, we were doing a lot of domestic, but also French cheeses and Italian cheeses. And we had some guests in that lived in France, and they said, you know, it was kind of disappointing that they were eating cheese here in the middle of the country that they could get in their hometown. And it was a kind of an epiphany went off, like, you know, that's what we need to be doing, is focusing on what we have. And there's a really, really great sheep's milk. Well, they do lamb and they do cheese as well, called Green Dirt Farms. And they're in the cookbook, which is one of the six featured farmers that we have in our book. And it's all about just kind of re-educating the local scene as to, you know, what's great in our region and what we have to offer and what we should all be serving and eating together. And
yeah.
You know, that's what's fun, to kind of find those local farmers who've been around forever, but not make it. It shouldn't be a trend.
Yeah, it shouldn't be a trend.
It's
that's the thing that drives me nuts about the, you know, what's going on. And it's like, this is what we've always should have been doing.
Yeah,
yeah, and that was a resurgence of that, I think.
I'm sure that that's what's going to end up being the norm. But you know, sometimes I can't wait for it to be that way and not be such a trend or effect.
Yeah, and people like seek these things out, whereas Felicity may have had it. I'm actually open to the Crumbs heirloom page of the cookbook. In 2006, when you were at the Beard House, you also had your sous chef in
tow. That was Dave Crumb.
Yeah, Dave Crumb.
And Dave Crumb's mother or family,
right,
has been running.
And that's a lot of what you'll find in Kansas City. I mean, a lot of areas you'll find that too. But, you know, our chef de cuisine, our first chef de cuisine, Dave Crum, well, his parents have their own farm. They do gorgeous, gorgeous heirloom tomatoes. They also grow melons and peppers and almost anything we want. They'll ask us every planting season, you know, what do you want to use next year, next season?
Yeah, they'll grow whatever we want.
And they'll grow it for us. But to have those connections, like someone who's working directly with us, and then, you know, we turn around and their family is then growing the food for us. That's very
common. Yeah, and the cool thing is, like, all the farmers come to us. You know, we definitely have a big market that we can go to, but, you know, they call us every week and they're like, what do you need? What do you want? And we just tell them what we want, and they bring everything to us. So
to the back door,
it's just a different culture. You know, we lived in Los Angeles for a while, and it was, you had to go seek these things out, where that, I think, is the thing that I hope changes, is that you don't have to go look for these things, that they're readily available. You know, it's sad that you can get Kraft macaroni and cheese at the grocery store a lot easier than you can get, you know, some produce that was grown by somebody down the street.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, that's,
I don't even know where Kraft is manufactured, like actually made, you know, that cheese powder sauce.
I think it just poof. It just exists.
Yeah. Yeah. it's like nitrogen in the air.
Exactly.
Yeah. What other farms, because you said you profiled six in the book. So you have Dave Crumbs, you have Paradise Lockers.
We have Thane Palmberg, who's from DeSoto, Kansas. He's the real deal. Salt of the earth guy. He does not grow anything flashy. I mean, it's turnips and potatoes and onions.
Yeah.
And
no flash there.
No flash.
Tubers and starch.
Yeah, yeah. And he's a great guy.
Green Dirt Farms. Yep, celebrate their cheeses and lamb from there. We also have Shadow Dairy.
Yep, Shadow Dairy.
Their milk is, you know, people can say milk is milk, but not until you've had their milk. It's got a sweetness to it. It's really rich. It's really beautiful. Their cows are treated so wonderfully. And it's a beautiful farm. We've been out there a couple times.
And then there's also Campo Lindo Farms, which is where we get all our poultry from.
And eggs as well.
Yep.
Eggs,
turkeys. Yeah.
So aside from those six farms, do you source from anywhere else? It feels like that runs the gamut of everything that
it's kind of interesting. We are really loyal with some of the people that we buy from, and you know,
because we're so small, you know, there's only so many tomatoes that we need, so we try to source from this kind of the same farmers to support them every year, but we'll flip-flop around depending on who's got the best stuff.
I mean, I think that's all about the relationship too. It's kind of like, you know, that's kind of the circle of things, is they take care of us, we take care of them, and you know, we have those relationships. We're always open for new relationships. But, you know, for instance, like the meat, you know, meat companies and things like that, it's, I stick with one person generally. And, you know, that's, and then, you know, you have a relationship with them. We've been open almost 8 years now. So, I mean, they'll bend over backwards for us and vice versa. You know, it's, we treat them well. We don't curse and throw stuff and send stuff back, you know.
Symbiotic.
Yeah, I mean, it's just that's how things should be.
When you continually work with some of the same farmers, you know what to expect on their growing seasons and what they can provide. And, you know, we'll make spaces available on the menu and kind of plan for, okay, Crumbs tomatoes, usually tomato season starts here, but their farm is going to start at this time, and we'll start to see tomatoes around this part, you know, this part of the growing season. So it makes it easier when you work with some of the same people.
Well, I guess I never thought of it like this. You know, obviously as a restaurant you need consistency.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But there must be expectation from clientele to see those tomatoes back up.
Oh,
and they must
absolutely
know them by name too.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, they know exactly what they're going to get. It's, you know, when we first opened the restaurant, we change the menu almost like every day. And I don't know, call it maturity or whatever. It's like you start to find these dishes that really work, that people love, and they end up starting to, you know, reappear year after year after year after year, you know, just kind of depending
on what it is. Customers
ask
for them. Yeah. And that's kind of what led us to do the book, because at 8 years, we felt like we had a story to tell. We felt like we had enough recipes to fill the pages. And, you know, customers keep asking, when's the gazpacho going to be out, or Crumbs tomatoes ready? And what is the recipe for that? So it kind of all came together once we started getting those questions and the right people were in line to help us do the book.
So actually, let's use the gazpacho as a jumping off point, because it's not a traditional gazpacho.
No, it's cleared. What we actually do is the crumbs, we buy all their split tomatoes from them, you know, that they can't do anything with.
Yeah.
And and we, you know, make a really rich gazpacho out of it. And then we clarify it. We just hang it in cheesecloth. It's almost like tomato water, but it's a lot more embellished than that. And then we take all their little pretty cherry tomatoes and things like that and build the soup from there. So
yeah,
it's really good with vodka in it too. It's a great martini.
It's a great cocktail.
Yeah, a little shooter. But what I love about what most people refer to as deconstructed is also a way to use things that wouldn't get used otherwise.
Absolutely. I mean, mm-hmm. and that's the whole idea. That's a lot of what we do. Even though there might be very refined things, I also, you know, really don't like to see things go to waste. And, you know, I've heard about some really high profile chefs that have some farms and things like that. And they'll just go through their farm. And if something's not perfect, you know, it's just they throw it out. You know, and it's like...
It definitely defeats the whole purpose of farming as a whole. I mean, back before there were restaurants, you know, with busy cities to feed people, you know, you ate what you had on the farm and that's it. And, you know, so we try to utilize ingredients as best as we can responsibly in our restaurant.
Yeah. I mean, is it hard for farms that you contract to grow to spec? I mean, are there some...
We really don't even ask them to do that, you know. It's just like we take what they have,
yeah,
and we use it, you know. And it, believe it or not, it makes their job easier and it makes our job easier. And I almost feel like they work harder to make us happy because we don't sit there and micromanage them. You know, it's just
we let them do their craft, and then when we get the product, you know, if it needs to be prettied up, we'll do that.
Yeah.
If it's perfect coming in the door, we'll celebrate.
I mean, a bad tomato is a bad tomato, you know, like a waxy tomato or something like that. But, you know, they don't come to us with that stuff.
Yeah.
So they may not look perfect or, you know, and that's fine with us. You know, we'll work with it.
Yeah. But I mean, from the imagery in the book, there is a simple perfection to a lot of the dishes themselves. So,
well, and that's the beauty of the seasons in spring and summer. You know, it's, you don't have to do much to food.
Yeah.
You know, at least produce in particular, it's pretty much is what it is. You know, in the winter and the fall, you really have to braise things and richen things, you know, and there's definitely February when the only things we have left is either whatever we've preserved or potatoes and turnips and onions, and that's it. So, you know, you got to work a little bit harder in those months to kind of shine things up.
Yeah, with the winter months coming up, I mean, what do you do with those things to create a dish that isn't bedraggled with, you know?
Sure.
It sometimes feels like it still becomes that.
But, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it just depends on what it is. Like, you know, sunchokes, for instance, come up in the spring, or wait, what is it? The late, they're basically a root vegetable. So we see them in spring and we see them in late fall. And it's whenever the ground freezes or thaws is when they harvest them. And so, you know, we'll make soups out of them and purees. And, you know, it's a special time of the year that comes twice. And it's usually like maybe four weeks long.
Yeah.
So, you know, we try to kind of feature those things when they come up and they're special. So.
Sunchokes are the only way I get to use my truffle slicer.
Yeah.
You know, and it's amazing. Do you guys have those here?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Because I was talking to somebody that had never even heard of them, but they're essentially the root of the sunflower plant.
Oh, I think all these years, yeah, I heard that and also known as Jerusalem artichokes.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, but I don't think I've ever equated the two things.
Yeah. And you know, they're pretty prevalent where we are. So
yeah,
they're a lot of fun. I love them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I mean, let's talk about potatoes, like real heavy starches, you know, rutabaga, that kind of thing where you're wintered over.
Yeah, I mean, you do a lot of glazing and roasting and, you know.
Vinegar, adding like, you know, champagne vinegar or something to some of the braise just to brighten it up and you know, give some spice to things.
Soups, purees. Yeah, that's
nice.
Kind of what ends up happening.
Yeah. Because it's funny, you know, the Midwest, well, New York has its seasons as well, but the Midwest.
We have four real seasons.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hot in the summer and cold in the winter and... You know, spring and fall are just literally the most beautiful times that there is.
Yeah. So sometimes I feel like restaurants in the Midwest have to work that much harder.
Oh, yeah.
To show the breadth of their, you know, cuisine.
Well, and what's interesting about where we're from, and we actually talk about it in the book, that weather is really harsh there. You know, we can have the summer. It can be either too hot or too dry, or it could rain like crazy for 4 weeks, and we literally see tomatoes for literally like 3 to 4 weeks.
Tornado season. Not to be cliche in Kansas, but it happens. You know, this last spring, we had a terrible, terrible tornado season, and it, you know, it pulls the plantings up out of the ground. And it, I mean, it took a long time this past year to get
This year was kind of rough.
Tomatoes and a lot of the planted produce was
greens, all that
stuff
gets wiped
out. Took a while for it to come to us.
Yeah.
So, but it is what it is. And I think that's kind of the beauty is figuring out how to work around it. So,
yeah. And luckily it's archived and all here in this cookbook.
Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back with Kobe and Megan Geraltz from Bluestem. Great.
This program has been sponsored by the Hearst Ranch. At Hearst Ranch, ranch manager Cliff Garrison describes their philosophy. Raising cattle on grass is both an ancient practice and one that is standard in much of the modern world. Sometimes the old ways are the right ways. We believe that our methodology is the right one for us. For more information on their premium grass-fed beef, visit HearstRanch.com.
Welcome back to the food scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com, here with Kobe and Megan Geralt from Blue Stem in Kansas City, Missouri.
Right.
Perfect.
Not Kansas.
Yeah. Sitting here with your cookbook, beautifully put out by Andrews McMeal?
McMeal.
Yeah.
It's kind of strange, but...
And it's beautiful, and it's just kind of stunning, and it is so you. But I also wanted to talk about this collaboration that you had. Often with cookbooks, you're assigned a photographer or writer, but
sure.
You had a really cool relationship in creating this.
Yes. Yeah, we...
Yeah, Bonjwing Lee was our writer and photographer who many people may know. He was the Ulterior Epicure, which has... He's a blogger. And I think a fairly famous one from what we've heard. And we are very fortunate. He's from Kansas City, born and raised. And yeah, he actually, when about the time we first opened up, which I think is about the time that he first started really writing online, he, you know, used to come in and just rip us to shreds about everything that we didn't know what we were doing.
Definitely our harshest critic.
And throughout the years, you know, actually Megan remembered who he was or what he looked like. And, you know, he'd come in a few more other times. And I think I had a heated email exchange with him. And
well, we tell the story in the beginning of, or Bonjwing does, when he writes the introduction to the book and tells the story of that heated email exchange, and really for the first time understanding the perception of a chef, and you know, the difference of, you know, coming in and being a diner but yet being a blogger, and then learning truly the behind the scenes of, you know, what it takes to run a restaurant and what it takes to be a chef and to have, you know, a daily thought process of creating menus and feeding people, and what that means. And he, you know, we became fast friends. He's very, very well traveled, very, very well eaten, even better than, he's probably the most well eaten person we know. And it was a natural fit to write the book with him. He's really, really wonderful writer, beautiful photographer. And it was an easy process in that sense, because the pictures in the cookbook that show the prepping of dishes or the completed dishes were actually real time pictures. None of them were staged or fake or anything. He was in the kitchen with us writing the recipes word for word as we went, and photographing them in real time. So
yeah, I don't know if the way we did the book was real orthodox or how people normally do it, but you just go in on Saturday morning, I'd walk into the walk-in and grab a bunch of stuff, and we just start going.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
it's pretty,
I always tell people the winter section was when we really figured out what we were doing. Spring
kind
of
not so much.
I don't know what we're doing.
So it was sectioned into seasons.
Yeah. And we tried to cook. It took us, it was a 2-year project. The first year was the actual prepping of the recipes and writing of the recipes. And then the second year was broken into two parts, where the first 6 months was, you know, editing, and then the last 6 months when it went to print. But the first year, so we started writing it in spring, and then spring got cut short because it took us too long to figure out what the heck we were doing. So by the time, you know, then summer would come around, and we would try to do all of summer in summer so that we had all the products to work with.
Yeah, because we were really worried about having to go back like in fall and try to, because something didn't work, or, you know, it's like, how do you go back in fall and try to fix something from the spring? And so,
yeah
it was
a couple of
it
times
challenging.
We did. Yeah. You know, we were like, can we get a, I remember Concord grapes was really hard. I was like, I really need Concord grapes. And it's like, you know, February. Uh-huh. And my farmer was laughing at me, but she happened to have some preserved grapes that she made into a puree in her cellar. So she gave those to me, and then, you know, we figured out
how to do it. I literally have there. A list of fleeting ingredients.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And who to contact when they're out of season.
Oh, that's great. I need one of those. Yeah. I'm not as organized as this one over here is. So.
So, I mean, going through season by season, you obviously learned something because you said winter was easier than spring.
Yeah.
What kind of tips would you have for, you know, a restaurant owner on writing a cookbook?
I think just, you know, we had a pretty, be definitely organized. We had a plan of, for the most part, which recipes we wanted to do. But then some were developed as we went. And then Bonjwing had a few favorites that he was like, you absolutely have to have this in the book. And we're like, come on, Bonjwing, that dish is so old, or, you know, that wasn't our favorite. But, you know, take advice from what do your customers want to see. I mean, most, a lot of our soups were requested for, and so those are definitely included. What's our favorite dishes?
One of the big things we heard too was, I mean, I was told to tone it down a couple times because it was getting too complicated, and, you know, you really want people to buy your books and use the recipe. So, you know, we adjusted some things and kind of made it so people can do this stuff at home.
Well, it's a fine line. Yeah. We didn't want to write a, you know, a real homey book because we wanted it's the story of the restaurant, and the restaurant, you know, we do fine dining, but we also have the lounge. So it had to hold the integrity of the restaurant. It had to tell the story of the restaurant, but it had to also be approachable because ultimately you're here to sell books and we'd like to do more. So that was tricky to find that middle ground. So there are some recipes in there that I would say are very challenging that maybe some people will bypass completely. And then there's a lot in there that, you know, are easy. And then some even you could do weekly if you wanted to, you know, but you know, it's just being realistic about what your guests want to see, and they want to do stuff at home.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I mean, I believe just from knowing you two that your guests want to see you in this book.
Yeah,
because, you know, I think so. They come to communal is, you know, the word that I think best describes it, not only in table, but kind of community center that you have created in Kansas City. I mean, this is going to be a relic of, you know, cooking there for ages because of that.
Well, and what, you know, what we were talking about before, you know, we started the show, we learned a lot from doing this too. And one of the biggest things was, you know, I was really worried about coming across, Megan wasn't as much as I was, but, you know, I know my peers are going to see this book, and I was really concerned that I didn't want to come across as some kid from the Midwest.
Yeah.
And, you know, I really came to realize that that's exactly what I am. And, you know, why am I trying to run away? Yeah. Why are we trying to run away from this? And from there, you know, it's really kind of taken us in a new direction and who we are and where we want to go and how we want to grow.
Well, and as a cookbook reader and as chefs, you know, I've never really seen a book from the Midwest represent the Midwest in a higher level. You know, there's a beautiful, gorgeous book out by Judith Fertig right now called The Heartland. And it's different chefs in different restaurants. It's kind of a collaborative book. But there's, you know, there's obviously the French Laundry is a big extreme on the West Coast, but there's that style of cookbook. And then you've got East Coast books, but there was nothing really in the middle of the country that showed how beautiful food can be. It was, you know, there's a lot of casserole cookbooks. There's a lot of church cookbooks, you know, those, that's kind of, even as a Midwest girl, that's what I think of when I think of Midwest eating, but there's a lot there to showcase. And so we really wanted our book to show all areas of what we could do in the center.
Well, we were talking about regional cuisine, fried chicken, barbecue. That's often not written about either or elevated to a point, but you have an upcoming project that might do so. Uh-huh.
Yeah, we really want to, I mean, I think that it's great how everyone is, you know, being local and sustainable, which again, I said, it shouldn't be a trend. It should be just the way it is. But I think that the next step is, you know, instead of taking those foods and cooking French food or Italian food or Spanish food, you know, it's like we should be celebrating where we are, you know, where we're from and where we are. And so that's, we really want to take things in that direction, you know, a lot more of the regional Midwest food, you know, the preserves and the cobblers and the pies and the, you know, the barbecue and the steaks, you know, the quality meats and, you know, it's, I think it's, I think it's something that should be explored more.
And this cookbook will help us expand our brand in that sense, because Bluestem will always stay the way it is. It will always be kind of our fine dining flagship. And then the next concept will be a little bit more high volume, a little bit more casual, or quite a bit more casual, I would say. But, you know, still focusing on those same regional ingredients. And the biggest thing that I always love to see with guests, even we had dinner last night at 11 Madison Park, and they had this wonderful chowder that they served. And you could just see the people next to us became really nostalgic. Yeah. And they started telling their server the story of how they were collecting, you know, seashells on the shore with their family. Yeah. And it's like when people start to remember those moments with family and friends, I mean, that's when you know you've hit it, when you're feeding people.
Yeah, we've noticed a lot when we talk to our customers at Bluestem, you know, they always want to talk. They know I'm from there, and they want to talk about this restaurant that used to be here, you know, and it's always the same conversation. It's like, you know, we used to go on Sundays and get chicken at this place, and it was just excellent. And, you know, there's a very kind of cliche mom and pop thought that comes through your head when you think about those things. And it's just because no one's really explored it.
Yeah.
No one's come in and given it the respect that it deserves and, you know, taken it to the next level. And that's what I think we're going to do with our next project.
Yeah. Do you have any tricks to your fried chicken or to your barbecue?
Yeah, actually, we put a few things.
Yeah.
We put, like pancake, dry pancake mix in with our flour,
yeah,
because it makes the crust expand.
Yeah,
it makes it crunchier.
Yeah.
And it steams it a little bit more.
And it steams it a little bit more. And that's something with fried chicken. And then barbecue, I mean, there's 100 different things for barbecue. Wait. Barbecue is a very subjective thing. People are crazy.
Is it micro regional in Kansas City? Like, which sauce is Kansas City barbecue?
Kansas City is smoke and sauce. Like, yeah. Texas is all. Is all, what do you call it? Is all just meat, and they only use beef, I believe, and they're not big on sauce.
Yeah.
And then the Carolinas, you know, they use mustard-based sauces, and like Tennessee is all sauce. We're like where everything meets.
Yeah.
We're kind of the mixing bowl of all the different regional styles.
Not to be biased, but Kansas City has the best barbecue for those reasons.
I mean, what places other than your upcoming project have the best barbecue?
There's
Kansas
Oklahoma City. Joe's.
Oklahoma Joe's is my favorite.
Which is probably, and then there's, you know, it's really interesting. I don't really know how to say this and be politically correct, but there is
you don't have to
okay. There's literally like, there's the white people that do barbecue and there's the black people that do barbecue. Yeah. And there's two totally different styles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the white people barbecue is really sticky and sweet.
Yeah.
You know, and theirs is a lot more spicy. And I mean, there's one isn't better than the other. It's just
two barbecue
different
place
styles.
In Kansas City is good for their own things. And me not being a native from there, but my husband is. So, you know, if we want ribs, he'll say, let's go to.
Yeah, you go to a certain place for ribs. Yeah. You go to a certain place for pulled pork and a certain place for brisket. And
that's kind of like the insider know of Kansas Cityans, you know, and you've got people coming in that want barbecue. It's like, well, what kind of barbecue
do you want?
What do you want to eat? What do you want to try?
But there isn't like any mixed race barbecue that combine those two things?
Not really. Like Jack Stacks is, you know, the big mecca. That's like they're the biggest ones. And
Jack Stack is like the holy temple of barbecue.
Yeah, it's but then the really old ones like LC's, like you walk in the door and you try not to slip on the floor. And Arthur Bryant's is, you know, in a really old part of town. And you know, it just really depends on what you want. But it's, you know, the stuff is special there. It's a big deal.
Yeah. I mean,
that's what people eat.
Yeah.
It's not very good for you, but it's damn good.
So are you going to make your fried chicken, your barbecue be healthier, be better for...
Well, I mean, I think we're going to add a little bit more to it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I do want to see some of the local produce and things mixed in a little bit more with some of the actual flavors that it is.
Well, like a lot of what we, you know, when I first moved to Kansas City with Colby and we opened Bluestem, I was like, all right, everybody talks about the steakhouses and, you know, there's barbecue and then there's steak in Kansas City. And I said, well, I don't feel like I can really be a Kansas Cityan unless I know the steakhouses. So we made a point to eat at every single steakhouse in Kansas City. And, you know, again, they're different for some of the same reasons the barbecue places are. Some of them are really old. Some of them are in different parts of the city and do certain things better than others. And, you know, what we did, we kept seeing seen in not only Kansas City steakhouses, but in Chicago and nationally, it's like they serve those same sides, you know, those hollandaise sauce and asparagus, and it's a lot of that stuff year round. And so at our new concept, you know, we're going to be taking the regional, you know, seasonal, you know, when it's tomato season, you're just going to get that, you know, fresh olive oil,
sliced tomatoes, salt, with tomatoes, a little sea salt, and
that's
oil,
it. You know, and do those things and change those sides out year round. And you know,
you might get turnips, but they might just be, you know, nice roasted turnips with a little bit of honey and salt and pepper, and that's it.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, I want those things to be themselves, to, you know, stand on their own.
Yeah.
That's what I think is good.
The classic
it, you know?
Steakhouse sides, but, you know, we'll take it to the next level and just really make it more seasonal as it should be.
So, really, the only thing you're wasting is paper for all the menus you have to print.
Yes.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, we're actually going to do like, we'll recycle the paper.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll have chalkboards and stuff too with who we're getting stuff from and
which featured farmers of the week and
wasting chalk.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Where does chalk sustainable, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I think so.
I don't even know. I think it's another thing like that craft, you know, mac and cheese sauce.
Yeah, it just arrives.
Happens. And do you guys have a timeline and ETA for this new restaurant project?
Well, we're still actually, we're still in the fundraising part, and it's not going badly by any stance. It's just we're getting ready to pull into the gate. So hopefully by next summer.
Summer or spring of 2012 is what we're planning for.
You get all these business guys involved in it, and they make it way too complicated.
Yeah.
They're like, we can't do this until we do this. And it's like, all right, just let us know when we can turn the stove on.
Yeah.
So do our thing.
Awesome. Well, you know, give me a holler when you turn the gas on. I'll make my way up.
Absolutely.
We will. Kansas. Definitely. Absolutely.
Thank you again. It's a beautiful book.
Check it out. Thank
Blue Stem, the cookbook.
Yep.
On shelves now.
Yep.
Awesome.
Fantastic. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Host Michael Harlan Turkell. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.